Last night on ABC News, it's okay to be chunky. It's okay to be chunky. Better to be a little chunky than to be thin. I still remember a couple of girls in my grade 10 class, Bonnie and Annie. Skinniest legs in the world. And I always think back on that and thought, well, they must have been really healthy. Now I'm finding out more and more. No. It's the kids who are a little chunky might be a little better. Obesity? No. But that was the report last night on ABC News. I got to tell you, Ryan. Yesterday, this is not a word of a lie. You know I take my bride out for lunch every Wednesday.
Absolutely. Yep.
I met a guy in Tim Hortons yesterday. He didn't care about me. Mm-hmm. I'm a nobody. He said, when's Pam Colleen going to be on next?
People love Pam.
She's getting a following.
Absolutely.
She's getting a following because look at this. And I am not kidding. Ryan, what am I holding here in my hand? I'm holding a newspaper.
Absolutely,
what's
yes.
the newspaper? It's the Globe and Mail. What's the date? It's April the 10th. What's the headline? Researchers question Tamiflu claims. Hello? Pam's been saying that for years. Let me read you the first paragraph. Independent researchers are urging governments. This is your taxpayers' money at work, folks. Independent researchers are urging governments to reevaluate policies to stockpile Tamiflu, citing strong evidence that the Roche antiviral drug does not reduce the risk of admittance to hospital or complications from the flu.
Mm-hmm. We've done this story a few times. We've had Dr. Tom Jefferson from the Cochrane Collaboration on, which is mentioned in this report. And I've already emailed Dr. Jefferson, and he's agreed to come on and talk about this story. Probably have him on next week.
See, I think that's why Bryna Warshawski's leaving town. It's just driving her crazy that all the stuff that Pam's been saying for years, which she thinks is crazy, it's all coming true. And today's headline in the Globe and Mail, the most recent example. Anyway,
I have to go, Andy. Somebody's calling for Pam.
Oh,
have a great show.
They'll be waiting in the lobby for autographs. Anyway, this is serious stuff we're talking about because lives are at stake. Now, in our first half hour, we're going to do two topics this morning: GMOs. Let's be careful with the term. Mm-hmm. What term should we be using? Genetically modified organisms.
GMOs, genetically engineered foods is another term. Bioengineered, you know, these are biologically engineered foods. So you hear different words bantered around. Genetically altered is not a correct term, though. We have to stick with words like genetically modified or genetically engineered.
Engineers toying with our food. Introduce our guest, Lucy, if you would, Pam.
Sure. This morning, I'm thrilled to have Lucy Charette. She's the coordinator for the Canadian Biotechnology Action Network out of Ottawa, and she has several campaigns that she's working on to help get consumers more aware about genetically engineered foods. So she has campaigns that she's been working on with genetically engineered fish, the genetically engineered apple, the genetically engineered trees. So she's going to give us an update on some of the things that are going on with regards to some of the politics of these foods. And recently as well, she's had this victory with regards to the delay in the planting of the genetically engineered alfalfa. And that has implications with regards to the honeybees.
Basically, we're talking about Frankenfoods.
Frankenfoods, yes.
People know what you're talking about about Frankenfoods. And Lucy joins us this morning. Good morning, Lucy.
Hello.
We know that we're on a tight schedule here. We have to have you off by 10:30. Let's talk about bees first, because people have heard all these horror stories in the news. All our bees are dying, it seems, and we need the bees. Bring us up to date on what's happening on that front.
Well, we only work on the issue of genetically modified crops, and of course, bees pollinate some of those crops. But the issue with the bees is more related to a class of pesticides called neonicotinoids, and we don't follow that issue very closely. The update that Pam was referring to when she mentioned bees was this genetically modified alfalfa. And alfalfa is a plant that would be pollinated by bees. So our concern relating to bees is actually that the bee becomes a vehicle for contamination, that they will take pollen from genetically modified alfalfa into farmers' fields onto non-genetically modified alfalfa plants. So that's the link here between genetically modified crops and bees. One of the links is the role that bees play and other pollinators in actually spreading unwanted genetically modified plants around. And this is, you know, just part of this bigger problem that we're releasing genetically modified plants, living organisms, into our environment, and we can't control them. Our environment's really complex, and there's a lot of interaction between all of these different organisms.
I'm not sure that all of our audience even knows what alfalfa is. I'm a farm kid from way back, and alfalfa, I mean, we hear about the corn and the beans and the big crops, but another major crop in the area is alfalfa, clover, hay for the cattle. Why is the alfalfa angle to the whole GMO story so important?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Alfalfa, very few of us really know what that is. You know, we might picture alfalfa sprouts on our sandwiches, in salads. But actually, alfalfa, as you say, is really important for hay. It's pasture. It's for animal feed. It's really important for dairy farming in particular. Grass-fed beef ends up relying on alfalfa and in a mix with other grasses. And so when we picture alfalfa, actually, it's bales of hay that we might picture. And so the company Forage Genetics International, alfalfa is called a forage crop because animals eat it as forage. They have put Monsanto's Roundup Ready, their herbicide-tolerant gene, into alfalfa. And alfalfa is also a perennial crop, and it's pollinated by bees. So it's quite unique in its role in agriculture, that it ends up being a part of meat and milk production. And it's also used to build the soil. Grain farmers use it, even vegetable farmers use it, to build up soil nutrition. So it's important for farming in Ontario, and it's actually also very clear that if a genetically modified alfalfa is introduced, it'll quite quickly contaminate, or the contamination risk is very high. And so for many years, farmers across the country, and in the last 2 years in particular, farmers in Ontario have been protesting the possible introduction of genetically modified alfalfa. And this spring, the company Forage Genetics International, that now has the right to sell this genetically modified alfalfa, has said that they won't put it on the market this spring. They're going to still think about it, and they could introduce it later on this year or next year. But for this spring, farmers in Ontario know that they do not have to contend with this risk of genetically modified alfalfa yet. Mm-hmm.
But I think a lot of people don't really understand the importance of the contamination issue and what this means for the farmers. Why would they be protesting this?
Well, of course, one of the core issues with genetically modified crops is that they end up being corporate property. So the genetic sequences are patented by companies. Monsanto owns the Roundup Ready trait that's in the genetically modified alfalfa, and that is corporate property that won't confine itself to where it's put. So the contamination means that farmers are at risk with contending with a big multinational corporation, and you know, maybe Monsanto won't bother taking farmers to court, but the property issue is one very serious issue. The other is that many farmers just don't want genetically modified alfalfa on their land. But as it happens, this alfalfa is engineered to be herbicide tolerant so that when it's sprayed with the herbicide glyphosate, it won't die. So it actually becomes itself a herbicide tolerant weed. So it's actually a very nasty weed problem for farmers if this genetically modified herbicide-tolerant alfalfa ends up on their land. And it's very complicated because of the dynamic of pasture where you have all these different grasses together. And so it's at the very outset a really big management problem that brings a possible, you know, threat of legal action. And then there's the whole issue of the fact that many farmers rely on a customer base, like customers who buy grass-fed beef, many of whom don't want anything to do with genetically modified products or would not want to see those animals fed genetically modified alfalfa.
Lucy, let me just boil this all down because I got want to cover several other subjects in the limited time we have. In a nutshell, you're saying this is one victory in the battle against genetically engineered foods. The fact that we won't be seeing genetically modified alfalfa, at least for another crop year.
It's a really important moment. And actually, people in London had protested genetically modified alfalfa. And so people in London and across Ontario should be very happy about this temporary reprieve, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was one of those protesters last year. I remember that.
You rabble rouser, you.
So listen, now, Lucy, you work on many issues. Another one that you've been working on is the genetically engineered tree. And we have not discussed this on the show yet.
No.
Yet it is huge. And even David Suzuki has worked on this issue over the years as well. So what's an update on the GE trees, Lucy?
There are some researchers at the University of British Columbia who've put out a press release announcing that they have developed a genetically engineered poplar, and it's engineered to be easier to process the wood into paper or biofuels. And this is something that we've seen as a wish. You know, it's something that companies had wanted to develop. And really, companies are doing this with every living plant. They want to produce it into an industrial product or a fuel. And we're very concerned that genetically modified trees are a huge risk to forest ecosystems. The contamination risk with trees is very large because the trees themselves are very large. They produce a lot of pollen and seeds that travel really far. What this means is the idea of growing trees in plantations for fuel and paper, genetically modified trees. And so we're working with a coalition of groups across North America to raise some very important questions about the ecological risks of genetically modifying
these
trees.
They don't stand up very well in the wind, do they?
Well,
I've seen them drooping over.
There's definitely some big questions about the health of these trees and what it means if contamination happens. You know, are you putting your forest ecosystems at risk or other trees, wild trees, because of the compromise to the wood itself? Yeah.
And you have a campaign as well educating consumers about the genetically engineered apple. And this is actually a Canadian venture, is it not?
It's a small Canadian company, yes, in Okanagan in BC, that has brought to the fore this technology that was developed in Australia to make an apple that doesn't brown when it's sliced. And when I tell people about that, they laugh. You know, people know that apples brown, and generally speaking, people are happy enough to either eat their brown apple or eat it before it browns. But this company has put forward this genetically modified apple that you can cut it and it won't brown for up to 15 days. And they're asking the Canadian and U.S. governments for approval. And people across Canada are writing into their grocery store head offices and asking the grocery stores to pledge not to carry the GM apples.
That's an amazing venture. It's absolutely disgusting. Changing the nature of nature. That's what these companies are doing.
You could cut an apple open and for 15 days it sits there and doesn't go brown.
That's what the company claims.
This is getting really scary, Lucy.
It's getting bizarre, and it is scary in a number of different ways, certainly from an environmental perspective, and there's no democratic debate. So we see these bizarre projects just actually coming closer and closer to reality.
Okay, so we've done the bees, we've done the trees, we've done the alfalfa, we've done the apple. Is there any other front that you're particularly watching now when it comes to genetically engineered foods and plants?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's not the end of the list in that there is this genetically modified fish that recently we confirmed that Health Canada is assessing this question of, will Canadians be eating genetically modified salmon? The company wants to put it on the market, and both Canada and the U.S. are assessing it. There is an approval already in Canada, which is Environment Canada has already decided that this company can produce the fish eggs or even the fish in Canada as long as, you know, it's on land and is contained. And actually, there are two environmental groups in Canada who have launched a legal challenge to that decision from Environment Canada. So we haven't yet seen the end of that question. And, you know, Health Canada could approve the GM fish sometime. We have no idea when.
We have about 2 minutes left, Lucy. Let me just ask you, for those who are just starting to plug into this issue, what do you suggest they do in terms of homework, in terms of joining efforts to make sure that we're aware of these issues related to genetically engineered food and plants?
Well, I would say that it's good to start at an easier spot, which is trying to figure out what's on the market that's genetically modified. our organization, CBAN, has a website, cban.ca, where people can see a list of just a few genetically modified crops that are grown in Canada. We've just named off a bunch of projects, but these aren't yet on the market. And so people can take control in the grocery store, and we urge people to do that and not to feel overwhelmed, but to be able to take a concrete step at home.
Terrific. We have to leave it there, Lucy. We thank you so much for your time. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Dr. Joel Ray on the issue of fat. We are obsessed with fat. In fact, what was the suggestion last week, Pam, that some people would, the survey showed that some people would rather be blind or lose a limb than they would be fat.
And this research is very important because what he discovered, of course, is that it's actually riskier to be skinny than it is to be obese. And it's not to say that obesity doesn't have its dark side. Of course it does. But it's very, very dangerous, actually, to be very skinny. And this is really new research, and it's very important research.
We'll be joined by Dr. Joel Ray in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. 10:30 now, just coming up to 10:30. We want to talk about fat. We want to talk about fat versus thin. Skinny is in. Skinny is in. Skinny is in. I still remember a couple of girls in my high school class who were, you could almost see through them.
Mm-hmm.
And we always thought that was good. Skinny is in. You're saying today, skinny is not where it's at
right.
when it comes to being healthy.
Yeah. We're going to get into some technical numbers here with our guests right now, but we're going to be talking about the BMI. And a BMI of 18.5 or under would be somebody who's skinny. And these people, unfortunately, have a lot of health risks associated with being skinny, even more so than those who are obese. And I'm not saying that obesity is okay. It's not. But unfortunately, we've associated a skinniness with being healthy, and it's just not so at all.
If you're built like a swizzle stick, if you can't throw a shadow at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you may not be very healthy. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly it, and that's what our researcher this morning is going to be telling us.
Okay, Dr. Joel Ray joins us now. Dr. Ray, appreciate you joining us this morning.
Glad to.
If you had to put all of what you've learned and what you want to share with us into a 10-second adage, what would it be?
That having a robust and good physical size is probably the healthiest state to be in, whatever your age. And that robustness would be defined by having a good amount of muscle and a decent amount of fat, not too much, but not too little either.
If I were to paint the picture, would I be thinking of someone like Marilyn Monroe? Is that what there are lots of other issues there, but if you look at her picture, is that what you mean by robust?
Robust would be somebody who essentially was a person whose body frame looked like they had a fair amount of, just decent muscle on their legs, arms, and who wasn't carrying a tire of central obesity or fat in the midsection. That would really be what would be sort of a robust physique in the way I'm using it.
Mm-hmm. And you get very technical in your research. You just published your research in the Journal of Epidemiology and Public Health. And you're talking about BMI, so numbers, and a lot of the listeners may not understand the BMI, so maybe we should start by explaining what the BMI is, the body mass index, and then we'll go from there.
For sure. And the essence of body mass index is it's a commonly used measure of sort of your body weight. And what it does is it puts in the top part of the measurement kilograms, what you would normally weigh on a scale, and then it divides that by a person's height. And it's not just their height, but it's their height times their height in the denominator, or the bottom part of the measure. So we can measure on any human being how much they weigh, and we can also know their height. We can measure it or ask them. And then we can calculate their BMI in kilograms per meter squared. And we can use that in a clinical setting, like a primary care clinic. And we can also have somebody do that on their own at home.
Yeah, well, I wish there were weight scales where it would show up in BMI. Let me just ask you this. Look who's been in the news the last two or three nights. Little Prince George, who's capturing the hearts of everybody in Australia and around the world. But look at his mom, Kate Middleton. Is she too thin?
She might be, and one of the reasons is that when people get photographed or they go on TV, they look different. And so stars always know in their own minds they need to sort of adapt to the non-radio version of the media. And accordingly, that may be a strategy people who are especially celebrities take.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see these runway models, don't we, Andy? And look at how rail thin they are. It's frightening. They don't look well. I've talked to people who work in the industry, and they attest to me all the time that these women are very sick, that they're very moody. They have a lot of addiction issues. They're just not well.
Pam, I see them on the streets of London mm-hmm. every day. I didn't know they could make jeans mm-hmm. with pant legs. It's like sticks. Mm-hmm. And you think, she's a grown woman. I mean, there's thin, there's ultra thin. You see it every day. It's scary.
Yeah. There was some research, and I think it was done here in Canada as well. I'm not sure if you were associated with this research, but it showed that if people were overweight with a BMI of, say, 25 to 30, that they were actually healthier than people with a lower BMI. I'm not sure if you looked at that in this recent research.
Well, we do. And really the concept is that healthy BMI is a reflection of the composition of the weight that the person actually weighs is from their bones, their muscle, and their fat. Mm-hmm. And so those individuals may have a balanced proportion of those things in which they have a sufficient amount of those physical materials that make up your body and create weight. A person who's very underweight, which, by the way, isn't just for women but also for men an issue now, those very underweight individuals may lack both sufficient muscle and fat. And the muscle is created by adequate nutrition and also by the physical things you do to create muscle. And mm-hmm. so people who are particularly underweight may not just have a nutritional issue, but may also have an issue related to how they achieve physical fitness and create muscle as part of their body weight.
This look of being skinny and thin, I always teach it in my classes about how it started essentially with the invention of the girdle, and then you fast forward to the flapper dancers in the 1920s. Unfortunately, during the Depression, of course, there were a lot of very emaciated people during the Depression because of starvation issues. But then if you fast forward to, say, the invention of the Barbie doll in 1959 and the Twiggy phase of the 60s and the skinny models appearing around then, you do see an evolution where skinny and thin has become very popular. And a lot of women in particular aspire to being that skinny and thin. But I think what your research is doing is it's a cautionary tale for all these people who are trying to have that look.
That's correct. Now, to be very frank, some of the people who are actually underweight in the studies that have been completed, those individuals are underweight also because they have another condition that puts them into that situation. And one of those conditions is lung disease. So that people who have bad lung disease tend to, by the nature of breathing all of the time with more energy requirements, they burn more energy and they tend to be more underweight because of the energy requirements of breathing. They also can't sufficiently exercise because of their breathing problems, and then they don't achieve muscle mass. And that's an example.
Doctor, is it your sense that in the media we're getting away from the fixation on the Twiggy image and we're starting to gently go back to a healthier, more robust image for women?
I don't know. I think that the consciousness is out there to realize that young men and young women do not have to be stick thin to be healthy, and that the very notion you've pointed out, that the very underweight person who's up on a runway showing fashion and aesthetics isn't necessarily a healthy-looking person in the mindset of maybe the common populace, as it should be correctly said. It is not healthy, and there's no need to encourage through any program that sort of underweight state. Now, I have to contextualize one thing that you were asking me about body mass index. When we understand body mass index and what its components are, one of the things we also have argued, and many have preceding the opinion of our group, is that for obesity, people who are particularly high risk for obesity-related illness like diabetes, heart disease, and stroke, those individuals are probably optimally assessed by waist circumference, a tape measure that literally goes around the abdominal waist, and you can use just the tape measure, or you can use waist circumference to hip ratio, waist to hip ratio as another metric. Those can be done easily in a clinic setting. And so for obesity, that's actually the fat deposition around the abdomen that we're most concerned about. Mm-hmm. For underweight people, the really stick thin people, body mass index is still probably the correct metric or measure to use in those individuals related to disease.
Well, there aren't many people who point to our thin crisis. There is all kinds of dramatic evidence. Let me just, because we're almost out of time, ask you, all of what's been said is true, but let me just ask you about the obesity crisis, doctor. It's very serious.
The obesity crisis is the big deal, because if you in London, Ontario today go into any physical place where there's people congregated, 100 of them, 25 of those 100 people are going to be obese. About 3 or 4 of them are going to be underweight. And about 50 of those 100 people are going to be what we would call, you know, normal weight area. It doesn't all add up because there's an overweight group I'm just leaving out for a moment. But obesity, in the real sense that we can define it by waist circumference or body mass index, is really still the elephant in the room, so to speak, and should be a priority of public health initiatives for young people and middle-aged and now older adults. So all of our work does not discount the crisis of obesity. We simply must realize that we, in our programs, don't need to create an unnecessary bystander of people who lose weight who don't need to, who are of healthy weight and muscle mass and are just fine, and they deserve no intervention at all.
Well said.
Okay.
Very well said.
Doctor, we want to honor, you said you had 10 minutes. 10 minutes is up. You're a physician researcher at Toronto St. Michael's Hospital, lead author of this new study just published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Public Health. We thank you for joining us this morning.
Glad to. You're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Ray.
Thank you.
Terrific. Okay, we want to take a short break. When we come back, I haven't warned her about this. I want to ask Pam Killeen about the big item in the news today, front page of the National Post. Deb Matthews, our health minister, so alarmed about the front page story in the Toronto Star, which says that the Tories are surging and the Liberals are going down. The Tories now with a 7-point lead. She is announcing today that we, the taxpayer, are now going to fund in vitro fertilization. Does she have a calculator? Does she have any idea of how much money this could cost? I'll be asking that of Pam. And again, I want to celebrate the story in the Globe and Mail this morning saying, what does it say now? Pam Killeen was right all along. Is that what it says in the fine print? It says, researchers question Tamiflu claims, which Pam has been saying for years. Little celebration when we come back in just a moment right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. 10:44, I'm going to have to call Deb Matthews and get her Pam Killeen's phone number, because yesterday when the phone didn't ring, that was Deb Matthews trying to reach you. I mean, Deb Matthews today announcing we are about to pour millions and millions of dollars. In fact, the estimate is $85 million. Which is a joke. Remember the Liberals, when they first estimated what it cost to move those gas plants, it was $23 million, then it was $40 million, turned out to be $1.1 billion. Same thing's going to happen to in vitro fertilization. Pam, we have you in studio. The last 2 weeks, you've been teaching your boot camp on this very subject of infertility, and here's the government about to waste hundreds of millions of dollars on in vitro fertilization, when you're saying that is not how you address the painful issue of infertility.
Right. So I've been seeing this problem increasing for several years now. And I decided the problem was so severe that I was going to, first of all, I decided it was going to be a documentary. So I actually wrote it as a documentary. But my producer got busy doing other projects. So I've actually taken all that material and I'm turning it into a book. I have this PowerPoint presentation that I teach about the decline in human sexuality. And that's going to be the subject of my next book. But essentially what I do in this upcoming book and in my class is I outline the problems, the many, many problems we're seeing with regards to human sexuality.
What are we seeing?
The low libido, infertility issues, lowered sperm count. More and more women are having problems conceiving. There's an increase in stillborns, increase in birth defects in children. It's just so many problems. And so what I first do in the first part of my class is I outline the research that shows the environmental estrogens, these synthetic estrogens that are coming from the chemical industry, and how they're monkeying with our hormones, essentially. And we've seen lots and lots of research to show that these chemicals are interfering with our fertility, and, you know, things like fecundity or the ability to conceive, things like sperm counts and sperm quality. So we know that there's a connection between all of these synthetic chemicals and how they interfere with our hormones and so on. But there's also the diet and how that has influenced negatively our hormones. And by reducing animal fat and cholesterol in our diets, of course, we've actually reduced foods in our diet that fuel our hormones, fuel things like testosterone, estrogen, and progesterone. So in order to produce these hormones, there has to be enough dietary cholesterol in the diet. And we're so afraid of eating cholesterol now, we're not getting the correct fuel to actually produce the hormones. So we see two things going on, Andy, that are compromising fertility, and that is the environmental estrogens coupled with this low-fat diet. And it's just been a tsunami. It's been the perfect storm, essentially, for creating all these problems with fertility. And our ancestors, Andy, knew what to do when couples had trouble conceiving. So here in North America, the Native Indians, historically, if couples were having difficulty conceiving, they would go on a diet high in bare fat. And over, you know, 1 or 2 months of this high-fat diet, the couple was then able to conceive a child. In many other cultures around the world, primitive cultures, they have food that is reserved for parents to be. And this is the most nutrient-dense food that they can obtain within their culture. And things like fish eggs, for example, in different cultures, whether you're in South America or if you're talking to the Inuit, fish eggs were reserved for parents to be. And that's because they knew through wisdom that fish eggs were incredibly nutrient dense in what are known as the fat soluble vitamins, also cholesterol, and some really important minerals that affect fertility.
So all
like
of
zinc.
all of that being said, mm-hmm. You see, I want you as a health expert to combine what you just said with the fact that you're a taxpayer. And you see that we're about to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on in vitro fertilization.
If people want that option, it's a free market. But the more couples I see are interested in getting healthy and then conceiving a child. So they're doing their utmost to get healthy first and then see if they can improve their fertility rates. So the more couples that are out there taking the initiative to change their diets, minimize their exposure to the environmental estrogen, let's see what happens with that first, because to me, that's more logical and is way less expensive.
We went to a naturopath who was really big when we were having children. We went to a naturopath, and every time we came in, Dr. Bob, God bless him, he would give us the count of the number of women who were having babies who were told by their doctors that they would never have children. And through good nutrition and a naturopathic counseling. The figure I remember, I don't know why I remember, one morning it was 28, and he would celebrate every time. So when I see this, that we're about to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on in vitro fertilization, it's not the answer.
No, I think that more people that understand that there's a nutritional component and an environmental component behind fertility issues, I think more people are going to take the initiative. But they're not getting the correct information, you see. That's the trouble, is people are not getting the correct information. People in the media, for example, you might read that the chemical lobbyists are all saying that bisphenol A and phthalates are perfectly safe, you know, and they're not. And then you might hear more and more information about the demonization of animal fat when animal fat plays a huge role in terms of balancing your hormones.
Wow.
So they're not, you know, animal fat never joined the dark side, but you still hear it even today in the news. You know, you hear demonization of saturated fat in the news today. And it's wrongful.
Okay. Now, I want to switch to another subject. This is incredible to me. This headline, folks, in the Globe and Mail today. And if you can't believe the Globe and Mail... No, it's interesting, Pam, how mainstream media is now catching on that all the traditional answers are not always the truth. And here's the headline, folks. Let me read it or check it out yourself. Page A3, page 3 of the Globe and Mail. researchers question Tamiflu claims. Group challenges assumption that antivirals are effective against flu pandemics and urges governments to rethink drug stockpiles. Let me just read the first couple of paragraphs. Independent researchers are urging governments to reevaluate policies to stockpile Tamiflu, citing strong evidence that the Roche antiviral drug does not reduce the risk of admittance to hospitals or complications from the flu. What Pam has been saying for years. And listen, Pam's often talking about the Cochrane collaboration. Well, here it is, second paragraph. The Cochrane collaboration, a global nonprofit research network, analyzed 46 clinical trials of the antiviral drugs Tamiflu and Relenza in a review published Thursday in the British Medical Journal. Their findings challenge the assumption that antivirals are a first line of defense against flu pandemics. What are they saying, Pam?
Well, I actually wrote this in my first book, The Great Bird Flu Hoax. We wrote about it in 2006, and the research back then was saying, you know, that the Tamiflu wouldn't work. Dr. Tom Jefferson has said on the show, when we've had him on in the past, he's saying that one thing that they're overlooking, what public health and the Health Canada's of the world, what they're overlooking is, how do you compare Tamiflu and its rather lack of ability of reducing symptoms, really, how do you compare that to, say, taking aspirin to reduce a fever, right?
Remind our listeners that we have spent hundreds of millions of dollars in Canada, as countries around the world have, to stockpile Tamiflu.
And the other component, Andy, that we've discussed on the show is the boycott against Roche, the manufacturer of Tamiflu, because they have actually hidden the data. All of their raw data, it's not available. Nobody can get their hands on it. The dog ate the data. Nobody can find it. And so there's been an uproar internationally in the scientific community because they're saying, how did Roche conclude that Tamiflu would help in the event of a pandemic? There's no evidence to show that. So if people want to reduce their fever and they want to take aspirin, it's probably a better recourse than turning to something that is as expensive as Tamiflu, number one. And number two, Tamiflu doesn't have the data to show that it's effective.
So you take these two stories. You take the story front page, I stress again, because I want people to go and check these stories out for themselves, front page of the National Post. We are about to spend, according to this announcement from Deb Matthews today, hundreds of millions of dollars on something whose outcome is very questionable, as most people would agree when it comes to in vitro fertilization. It's a very emotionally, psychologically, financially, it's a very, very taxing and questionable process. And now this evidence that the money we have spent, and the figure I recall was $300 million on stockpiling Tamiflu, that it just wasn't what we were told.
It was a waste of money.
It was a waste of money.
Absolute waste of money. And speaking of money, there were a couple of other articles I just brought to your attention. This editorial in the National Post, Kelly McParland, saying Canada spent $41 billion on healthcare and little changed. Do you guys want to spend more, essentially, is what she's saying. And Carly Weeks in the Globe and Mail saying doctors should prescribe fewer useless tests, treatments to provide better care, medical campaign says. So we're seeing two major, I think, important articles anyway, saying, you know, the more money we throw into healthcare, the less we're getting for it. So spending is not working for us. Spending money on healthcare hasn't been working. The more money we've been spending on healthcare, the worse off we are.
Wow, we got to get you in touch with the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. I mean, they're the people who are on the air all the time trying to save tax money. You could save hundreds of millions of dollars if you could just have a coffee with Deb Matthews and
well,
get
I don't.
Results.
I mean, I don't see that. I mean, the lobbyists obviously have more money and power than you and I do, Andy. So I think what has to happen is you educate one person at a time to take control of their health and do things at home under their own roof to be healthier, become healthier, and prevent disease. That's going to save the money in the long run.
Any boot camps coming up?
Starting April 30th, I'm teaching my two-part class on digestive wellness. So if people want more information, they can go to my website, which is just my name, pamkilleen.com, and just click on upcoming events.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Pam. 11 o'clock news on the other side.